Hey guys, this is going to be health assessment, the neuro or the neurological system. Again, with the AI generated host, just be mindful of the hashtag tag tag thing with the glitch that they do, or factor XA and they call it factor ZA, or with like cranial nerve one, they'll say CNI or CNII, just random stuff like that. Regardless, the material is still really good. So I hope you guys enjoy. This is going to be health assessment, the neurological system.
Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, it's in with blood.
He's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in. The top of the vehicle was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
There were 45 minutes of CPR, no return of circulation. We can stop CPR. 6-0-3.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. This is where we take all that complex source material, you know, textbooks, clinical guides, and really break it down into something structured, something you can actually use.
Exactly. And today we're tackling the neurologic system. Think of this as building a solid reference map, not just for exams, but for real understanding.
Right. It's about getting the structure, the function, and then the so what? How does this actually apply, moving past just rote learning?
That's the mission. We're synthesizing it all so you can build that clinical reasoning muscle.
Okay, so we've got sources covering the CNS, the PNS, all the detailed assessment techniques, and big clinical topics like stroke, CVA.
Mm-hmm. And we'll get into the abnormal findings, too, the stuff that could be really challenging, like spinal cord syndromes, different types of posturing. It all connects back.
You have to see it as a system, right? Like you said, if you know how it's wired.
You can figure out what happens when a wire gets cut, basically. Right. It helps predict the clinical picture.
Okay, let's unpack this then, starting right at the beginning. The fundamental architecture, the brain and spinal cord.
Right. The central nervous system, the CNS. That's your command center.
Brain and spinal cord. Protected, right?
Very protected.
Yeah.
You've got the bone, of course, skull and vertebrae, and then those membranes, the meninges, three layers.
Dura, arachnoid, and pia mater. I remember those.
Yep. And floating within that, cushioning everything, is the cerebrospinal fluid, CSF. It circulates, acts as a shock absorber. Super important.
Okay, so inside the skull, the brain itself, it's not just one big blob, is it?
Huh. No, definitely not. Four main regions you got to know. The cerebrum, that's the big, the encephalon, the brainstem, and the cerebellum tucked in back.
The cerebrum, that's the two halves, the hemispheres.
Exactly. Left and right hemispheres, connected by that thick band of nerve fibers, the corpus callosum, allows them to talk to each other.
And each hemisphere has lobes. Mm-hmm. Knowing these is key for figuring out where a problem might be, yeah.
Absolutely essential. Location dictates function. So up front, you have the frontal lobe. Think of it as the executive suite.
Personality, decision making.
Right. Judgment, reasoning, emotions. And crucially, voluntary movement. The motor cortex is here. Mm-hmm. And remember that crossover.
Left brain controls right body. Right brain controls left body. Always got to remember that.
Always. And also in the frontal lobe, usually on the left side, is the Broca area.
Ah, Broca's. That's for speech, but specifically making the sounds right, motor speech.
Precisely. So if someone has damage there, say from a stroke,
they can understand you, but they struggle to get the words out. Like, the speech is broken, halting.
That's it. Exactly. It's called expressive aphasia or non-fluent aphasia. Really frustrating for the patient.
Okay. Moving back from the frontal lobe.
You hit the parietal lobe. Think of this as the main sensory interpretation center.
So touch, pain, temperature, it all gets processed here.
Yep. And not just feeling it, but understanding it. Like recognizing shapes by touch, knowing if something's hot or cold, telling if you're being touched by one point or two points close together, that two-point discrimination. Reading comprehension is linked in here too.
Gotcha. And then on the sides.
Temporal lobes. Easy one to remember, temples, near the ears. So hearing is the big one, interpreting sounds. Also taste perception.
Okay. Hearing and taste. And right at the back.
That's the occipital lobe. Purely visual processing. Light comes in the eyes, gets turned into signals, and the occipital lobe makes sense of it all. It's the primary visual center.
Okay, that covers the main lobes. But you mentioned deeper structures too, the diencephalon.
Right, deep in the core, contains two really important parts, the thalamus and the hypothalamus.
The thalamus, isn't that like a relay station?
That's a great way to put it, the grand central station for sensory info. Almost all sensory input coming out from the body goes through the thalamus before it's directed to the right part of the cerebral cortex for interpretation. Pain, touch, temperature, it passes through there.
Okay, and the hypothalamus sounds important.
Oh, it's incredibly important. Tiny structure, but it's the master regulator for homeostasis, keeping your internal environment stable.
Like what specifically?
Think vital functions, water balance, appetite, your body temperature, blood pressure, heart rate, sleep-wake cycles, even involved in emotional responses. Damage here can cause huge problems systemically.
Wow. Okay. Below that, you said the brainstem. Why is that area so critical in like emergency situations?
Because it connects the cerebrum, the spinal cord, the cerebellum.
Yeah.
But more importantly, it controls the absolute basics for life.
Breathing, heart rate.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially the medulla oblongata, the lowest part. It directly regulates heart rate, blood pressure, respiration. If you have swelling or damage there, like brain herniation pushing down.
It can be catastrophic, like immediate decline.
Instantaneous, yeah. It's why any signs of brainstem compression are a neurological emergency. It also relays motor signals and is involved in reflexes like swallowing, coughing, vomiting.
And didn't you mention something about consciousness being linked to the brainstem too?
Yes, the reticular activating system, or RAS. It runs through the brainstem. It's key for maintaining alertness and wakefulness.
So when we check someone's level of consciousness, their LOC, we're indirectly checking the brainstem.
You absolutely are, particularly the midbrain and pons regions. If someone's comatose or very difficult to arouse, there's often dysfunction in the RAS within the brainstem.
Okay, that makes sense. And the last major part, the cerebellum, tucked away at the back.
Yep, underneath the occipital and temporal lobes. It doesn't initiate movement itself, but it coordinates it.
Like an editor, making things smooth.
Perfect analogy. It ensures movements are coordinated, smooth, and balanced. It maintains equilibrium, muscle tone. If you see someone with jerky, uncoordinated movements, what we call an ataxic gait, or they can't do smooth finger-to-nose tests, the cerebellum is often the culprit.
Okay, that maps out the brain pretty well. Now, the other part of the CNS, the spinal cord.
Right. The information superhighway extends down from the medulla, usually to about the first or second lumbar vertebra, L1 or L2.
And it's not just carrying messages up and down. It handles some things locally.
Yeah, reflexes. The reflex arc. That's the simplest neural circuit. You get a stimulus.
Like tapping the knee tendon.
Right, the patellar reflex. Mm. Stimulus activates a sensory neuron. It travels into the spinal cord, synapses directly, or via an interneuron with a motor neuron, which then travels out and makes the muscle contract, all without involving the brain initially.
So it's a quick local response, good for protection, and we use it for testing specific spinal segments.
Exactly. If the reflex at a certain level is absent or weird, it tells you something might be wrong with the nerves or cord at that specific segment.
Now, for the messages traveling up to the brain, the sensory pathways, you said there are two main ones.
Two major ascending tracts you really need to know. First, the lateral spinothalamic tract.
Okay, spinothalamic. Spinal cord to thalamus. What does it carry?
This one carries your more basic or crude sensations. Think pain, temperature, and crude touch, like just knowing you're being touched, but not finally identifying what it is.
So if someone steps on something sharp, that signal goes up the spinothalamic tract.
Primarily, yes, that's sure. Pain, the heat from the stove.
Yep.
That's this pathway.
And the other major sensory route?
That's the posterior columns, sometimes called the dorsal columns. These carry the more sophisticated, finely tuned sensations.
Like what?
Position sense, knowing where your limbs are in space without looking, that's proprioception. Vibration sense, feeling the buzz of a tuning fork. And fine, discriminative touch, like being able to identify an object by feel alone.
Okay, so posterior columns are for the detailed sensory info. Why is knowing the difference between these two tracts so important clinically?
Because certain diseases preferentially affect one tract over the other. For example, vitamin B12 deficiency, tertiary syphilis, sometimes MSs, these often hit the posterior columns hard. So the patient might lose vibration sense or proprioception way before their pain or temperature sensation is affected. It helps pinpoint the problem.
Got it. So loss of vibration sense in the feet points more towards posterior column issues than spinothalamic. That's the kind of reasoning.
That's exactly the reasoning.
Okay.
Now going the other way, motor commands down from the brain.
Descending pathways.
The big one is the corticospinal tract, also called the pyramidal tract.
Corticospinal. cortex to spinal cord sounds voluntary.
It is. This is the main pathway for conscious, voluntary skills movements. Writing, playing piano, precise hand movements. That's corticospinal. It starts in the motor cortex.
In the frontal lobe where we started.
Right. And most of these fibers cross over to the opposite side in the medulla. The decussation is why a left brain stroke causes right-sided weakness.
Okay, corticospinal for voluntary skill. Are there other motor pathways?
Yep. There are the extrapyramidal tracts. These are sort of older pathways, more involved in regulating involuntary movements, muscle tone, balance, posture.
So less about fine skilled actions and more about background control.
You could say that. Damage here doesn't usually cause paralysis like corticospinal damage does, but it often leads to problems with muscle tone, like rigidity or involuntary movements, like the tremors you see in Parkinson's disease.
Okay, that sets up the CNS structure and pathways beautifully. Now let's zoom in on those cranial nerves. They feel really important for quick clinical checks.
They are incredibly high yield. 12 pairs coming directly off the brain and brainstem, mostly. They give you a window into brainstem function, especially.
We gotta know them all. Do you use a mnemonic?
Yeah, the classic one works. On Old Olympus Towering Top, a fin and German viewed some hops. OOOTTAFAGVSH. Maps to nerves I through 12.
And we also need to know if they're sensory, motor, or both, right?
Crucial. The rhyme for that is, some say marry money, but my brother says big brains matter more. SSMBMBSBBMM tells you the type for each nerve in order.
Okay, let's run through them. CNI.
CNI, olfactory.
That's right.
Sensory S, for smell. Not always tested routinely unless there's a specific concern like head trauma.
CN2, optic. Sensory S, that's vision.
Yep. We test this with the Snell and Eye chart for acuity and checking visual fields by confrontation, seeing if they can detect your fingers coming in from the periphery.
Then we hit a group that works together, 3, 4, and 6.
Right, the oculomotor trio. They control eye movements. CN3 oculomotor is motor M. It does most of the heavy lifting, moves the eye up, down, medially, raises the upper eyelid.
And pupil constriction. That's CNA3 too, right?
Yes, critical function. Parasympathetic fibers run with CMA to constrict the pupil. CMA, trochlear, also motor M. Controls the superior oblique muscle, mainly moves the eye down and inward.
Kind of specific.
Yeah. And CNVA abducens, motor M, controls the lateral rectus muscle, abducts the eye, moves it outward, laterally.
Okay, so why are these three, especially CNVA, so vital in, say, an ICU setting or checking someone after a head injury?
Because changes here are often the earliest sign of trouble, specifically rising intracranial pressure, ICP. As pressure builds inside the skull, it can compress the brainstem. CN3 is vulnerable to this pressure.
So what do you see?
You might see the pupil on the affected side becoming sluggish to react to light, or fixed and dilated. Eyelid drooping, ptosis, can happen too. A change in pupil size or reactivity is a huge red flag signals potential herniation, needs immediate attention.
Got it. Okay, moving on. CNV.
CNV, trigeminal, it's both B. Big nerve. Sensory for the whole face, forehead, cheeks, chin. We test this with light touch in those three areas, and it's motor for the muscles of mastication.
Chewing. So we ask them to clench their teeth, feel the master muscle.
Exactly. Then CN7, facial. Also both B. This is all about facial expression.
Smile, frown, puck out cheeks, close eyes tightly.
Yep. We're looking for symmetry. It also carries taste sensation from the anterior two-thirds of the tongue and some parasympathetic fibers for glands.
Is there a quick way to tell if facial weakness is like a stroke versus something like Bell's palsy?
There is a key difference usually, and a central lesion like a stroke affecting the upper motor neurons in the brain, the forehead muscles are often spared because they get input from both sides of the brain. So the person can still raise their eyebrows even if the lower face droops.
Okay.
But in a peripheral lesion like Bell's palsy affecting the facial nerve itself, CN7, the entire side of the face is weak. They can't raise the eyebrow, can't close the eye fully, mouth droops. That forehead sparing is a really useful clinical pearl.
Good one. Okay, CN8?
CN8, acoustic, or more correctly, vestibulocochlear. Sensory S, two
yes.
Parts. The cochlear for hearing,
no.
Just test with whispered voice or finger rub, and vestibular for balance and equilibrium.
Right. Then IX and X often get tested together.
Yeah, CNNX, glossopharyngeal B, and CNX vagus B. They're heavily involved in swallowing and the gag reflex.
So when we ask the patient to say,
we're watching the soft palate and the uvula. They should rise symmetrically. That checks IX and X motor function. CNIX also does taste for the posterior third of the tongue and sensation from the pharynx.
And the vagus nerve, CNX, is huge, isn't it? It goes way down.
It's massive. Mm-hmm. Vagus means wandering. It carries the main parasympathetic outflow to the heart, lungs, stomach, intestines, slows heart rate, aids digestion.
Yeah.
Really crucial for that rest and digest function.
Yeah. Okay. Merely there, CNVI.
CNFs, spinal accessory. Motor M, easy one to test.
Mm-hmm.
Shrug shoulders against resistance, test the trapezius muscle, and turn head against resistance, test the sternocleidomastoid muscle.
And finally, CN12.
CN12, hypoglossal.
Mm.
Motor M, controls tongue movement. Ask the patient to stick out their tongue. It should protrude midline. Then check strength by having them push their tongue against the inside of their cheek while you resist from the outside.
What if it doesn't come out straight?
If there's damage to CN12 on one side, the tongue will deviate toward the side of the lesion when protruded, because the muscles on the good side push unopposed. It's a very specific localizing sign for CN12 damage.
Okay, that's the 12. They're technically part of the peripheral nervous system, right? The PNS.
Yes. The PNS is everything outside the brain and spinal cord. So the 12 pairs of cranial nerves and the 31 pairs of spinal nerves that branch off the cord.
And these peripheral nerves carry different types of signals.
Two main types of fibers. Somatic fibers connect to skeletal muscles, the ones you control consciously, voluntary movement. Autonomic fibers connect to smooth muscle, like in your gut or blood vessels, cardiac muscle, and glands, the stuff that runs automatically, involuntarily.
And that autonomic part is the autonomic nervous system, the ANS.
Correct. The ANS is all about maintaining internal balance, that homeostasis we talked about with the hypothalamus. It has two main divisions that usually work in opposition.
The famous sympathetic and parasympathetic.
Right. The sympathetic nervous system. Think fight or flight. Its nerves mostly come from the thoracic and lumbar spine segments, T1L2. It gets you ready for action, speeds up heart rate, increases blood pressure, dilates pupils, slows down digestion to divert energy.
Adrenaline rush.
Pretty much. Then you have the parasympathetic nervous system. Think rest and digest. Its nerves come from the brainstem via those cranial nerves, 3, 7, 9, X, and X we mentioned, and the sacral spine segments, S1, S4. It does the opposite.
Mm.
Slows heart rate, lowers blood pressure, constricts pupils, stimulates digestion, conserves energy, and handles routine maintenance.
So normally these two are in balance, keeping things running smoothly.
Ideally, yes.
Yeah.
But stress, injury, disease, they could throw this balance way off.
Okay, one more thing related to the PNS structure. Dermatomes, we see those diagrams everywhere. Why are they so useful?
A dermatome is the specific area of skin that gets its sensory input from a single spinal nerve root. Knowing this map is clinically invaluable.
How so?
Let's say a patient comes in after a fall and says, I can't feel anything from my nipples down. You look at a dermatome chart, and the nipple line corresponds roughly to the T4 spinal level.
Ah, so it immediately tells you the injury is likely at or above T4 in the spinal cord.
Exactly. Or if sensation is lost below the umbilicus, that points to T10. It allows you to localize the level of a spinal cord lesion just based on sensory findings. It turns a vague symptom into a much more precise anatomical location. Very powerful tool. Okay, so we got the anatomical foundation. Now, when we actually see a patient, we start by talking to them, getting the subjective data, their story.
Right, the health history. And for neuro, some questions are particularly loaded with clinical clues.
Absolutely. Take headaches, for instance. Everyone gets them, but the pattern matters. The sources highlight a specific type, a headache that's worse in the morning, maybe wakes a person up, and gets better after they've been up and moving around for a bit.
Why is that pattern such a red flag?
Because it classically suggests increased intracranial pressure, ICP. When you lie flat overnight, CSF pressure can build more easily, especially if there's something obstructing flow, like a tumor or swelling. Standing up helps gravity drain things a bit. It's not definitive, but it definitely warrants further investigation. Much different from a typical tension headache.
Good point. What about seizures? What are the key things to ask?
First, always ask if they experience an aura before the seizure.
What exactly is an aura in this context?
It's like a warning sign. It could be a strange smell, a flash of light, a weird feeling, a sudden sound, even a motor twitch. The specific type of aura can actually help pinpoint where in the brain the seizure is starting the seizure focus.
So it's diagnostically useful.
Very. We also need to know the type of seizure. Was it generalized, whole body, shaking, focal, just one part of the body, absence, staring spells, deep mel. And critically, for anyone with a known seizure disorder, are they on medication? Do they wear a medical alert bracelet? That's vital safety info for first responders.
Makes sense. And if someone complains of numbness or tingling, we called that paresthesias earlier.
Yeah, paresthesias. You need to map it out. Where is it? Is it on one side, both sides? Does it follow a specific pattern? If it's in the hands and feet, kind of like wearing stockings and gloves?
That stocking glove pattern.
Right. That strongly suggests peripheral neuropathy damage to the peripheral nerves themselves, often seen in diabetes or chronic alcoholism, because the longest nerves get affected first. But if the numbness sharply follows a dermatome line we talked about,
then you suspect the problem is higher up in the spinal cord or nerve root for that specific level.
Exactly. The pattern tells you where to look.
We also ask about memory loss. How do we differentiate types?
We usually distinguish between recent and remote memory. Trouble with recent memory, like forgetting what they had for breakfast or repeating questions, is common in acute things like delirium or in dementia.
Whereas remote memory...
That's recall of past events, childhood memories, historical events, things learned long ago. This tends to be preserved longer in dementia, but can be affected in more widespread damage to the cerebral cortex. Yeah. Asking about both helps characterize the cognitive decline.
Now, we can't just ask about physical symptoms. The psychosocial impact of neurological issues is huge.
It really is. Think about it. Problems with movement, sensation, thinking, speaking. These strike at the core of a person's independence and self-identity. There's often a lot of fear, anxiety, embarrassment.
So people might downplay their symptoms.
Very possibly. They might be afraid of what the diagnosis means, afraid of losing control or becoming a burden. So building rapport and trust is essential before diving into really sensitive questions about, say, incontinence or severe memory lapses. We need to be incredibly sensitive.
And there are cultural factors, too. The sources mention the stroke belt.
Yeah, that's a well-known epidemiological finding. There's a region in the southeastern U.S. and an even higher risk area within it called the stroke buckle, where stroke incidence and mortality rates are significantly higher than the rest of the country.
Why is that?
It's likely multifactorial, higher rates of hypertension, diabetes, smoking, dietary factors, maybe access to care issues. It highlights how geographic and socioeconomic factors play a role.
And culturally, how symptoms are described can differ too, like using the term nerves.
Right. In some cultural contexts, symptoms like anxiety, palpitations, fatigue, even pain might be described generally as having bad nerves or just nerves. As clinicians, we need to gently probe what that means for the individual patient. Is it anxiety? Is it chest pain? Is it paresthesia? We can't just assume.
Good point. Lastly, in the history, we cover lifestyle and medications. Seems obvious, but important.
Crucial for prevention and identifying risks. Asking about seatbelt use, helmet use when biking or on motorcycles, that's a primary prevention for traumatic brain injury. Asking about exposure to pesticides or industrial chemicals can be relevant for certain neuropathies.
And repetitive movements.
Yeah, occupations or hobbies involving repetitive motions increase the risk for things like carpal tunnel syndrome or herniated discs, which are essentially nerve compression injuries.
Medication review is always key. The source mentions a specific drug, oxybutynin, for a client with MS.
Right. Linda Hutchison, in the case study, uses oxybutynin ditropan. This is an anticholinergic medication. Its main effect here is to relax the bladder muscle, the detrusor muscle.
So why would someone with MS need that?
Multiple sclerosis often causes neurogenic bladder dysfunction, leading to symptoms like urinary frequency, urgency, and incontinence, because the nerve signals controlling the bladder are disrupted. Oxybutynin helps calm down that overactive bladder, reducing incontinence episodes. It's managing a specific neurological symptom to improve quality of life.
Makes sense.
No.
And there was a warning about common over-the-counter drugs, NSAA.
Yes, a very important one. NSAAs like ibuprofen, Advil, Motrin, or naproxen, Elevoif, while they're great for pain and inflammation, they can interfere with platelet function, slightly increasing bleeding risk.
So why is that a specific concern neurologically?
Because many patients at risk for stroke or who have had a TIA or certain heart conditions are already taking an antiplatelet drug like low-dose aspirin specifically to prevent clots. If you add an NSAE on top of that,
you get a double hit on platelet function, increases bleeding risk significantly.
Exactly, including the risk of gastrointestinal bleeding, but also, importantly, hemorrhagic stroke. So the advice is crucial. Patients on aspirin for stroke prevention should always consult their doctor or pharmacist before taking NSAIDs regularly. Don't just grab them off the shelf.
Okay.
History done. Now we move to the hands-on part, the objective assessment. And like we said, this isn't just random checks. It's systematically mapping out the nervous system function based on that anatomy.
Starting at the top with mental status.
Right. Assessing overall brain function. Key components are level of consciousness, LOC. Are they alert, lethargic, obtunded, stuporous, comatose. Then orientation? Do they know who they are, where they are, the date, time, and the situation while they're here? Person, place, time, situation.
We also check memory again here, right? Both recent and remote.
Yeah.
And things like judgment and abstract reasoning.
Judgment, like asking what they'd do if they found a stamped, addressed envelope on the street. Abstract reasoning, asking them to interpret a proverb like, people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. And using a standardized tool is really helpful here.
Like the SLUMMS test mentioned in the sources.
Exactly. The St. Louis University Mental Status Exam, it's a quick screen, gives you a score, helps quantify cognitive function and track changes over time. Good for detecting mild cognitive impairment or dementia.
Okay, after mental status, we look at the motor system. What's the first step?
Inspection. Just look at the muscles. Are they symmetrical? Is there any obvious wasting, which we call atrophy? That often indicates LMN problems or disuse. Are there any involuntary movements? Mm-hmm. Fasciculations, those are like little twitches or ripples under the skin, often seen with LMN disease like ALS. Or larger movements like chorea jerky, dance-like, purposeless movements seen in Huntington's disease. Or ectics repetitive stereotype movements or sounds.
Got it. After inspection, we check strength and tone.
Yep. Test strength by having them push and pull against your resistance, arms, legs, comparing sides. Graded on a 0 to 5 scale. Then assess tone by passively moving their limbs through the range of motion.
What's normal tone feel like?
Normal tone has a slight, smooth, consistent resistance throughout the movement. Abnormal tone is key diagnostically.
How so? What are the abnormal types?
You might find flaccidity or hypotonia, like the limb feels limp, heavy, no resistance. That usually points to a lower motor neuron, LMN problem, damage to the nerve root or peripheral nerve going to the muscle. Often goes along with atrophy and hyperflexia.
Then the opposite.
Increased tone. This could be spasticity, where you feel increased resistance that might suddenly give way, like a clasp knife, often worse in certain directions. Or rigidity, where the resistance is constant throughout the range of motion, like bending a lead pipe. But spasticity and rigidity typically point to an upper motor neuron, UMN, lesion damage in the brain, or spinal cord pathways above the level of the LMN. Think stroke, MS, spinal cord injury. Usually associated with hyperreflexia.
That UMN-LMN distinction seems really fundamental.
It's one of the core organizing principles of neuroassessment.
Okay, motor system done. Now, cerebellar function, coordination, and balance. How do we test that?
First, watch them walk. Observe their gait. Is it steady? Symmetrical? Are the arm swings normal? Then challenge their balance.
Like asking them to walk heel to toe, tandem walking.
Exactly. That really stresses the cerebellar system. Also, just walking on toes, then heels. Observe for any instability or ataxia. Know that older adults might normally have a slightly wider stance and shorter steps, so consider age.
In the Romberg test, everyone seems to do that one.
It's important, but you have to interpret it correctly. Ask the patient to stand with feet together, arms at sides. First, with eyes open. Check for swaying. Then, have them close their eyes.
What's a positive Romberg?
A positive Romberg is when the patient is relatively stable with eyes open, but loses balance or sways significantly only when they close their eyes.
So what does that tell you?
It tells you they were relying on their vision to maintain balance, and when that's removed, their proprioception, position sense in the posterior columns, or vestibular function, inner ear, isn't good enough to compensate. It's not primarily a cerebellar test. If they sway badly, even with eyes open, that's more likely a cerebellar issue.
Ah, okay, that's a key distinction. What about coordination tests?
These directly test cerebellar function. Things like the finger nose test, have them touch their nose, then your finger back and forth while you move your finger. Look for smooth, accurate movements.
What if they overshoot or undershoot?
That's called dysmetria, and it's a classic sign of cerebellar disease. Other tests include rapid alternating movements, like quickly flipping their hands back and forth on their thighs, or tapping their thumb to each finger rapidly. And the heel-to-shin test have them run the heel of one foot smoothly down the shin of the other leg. Clumsiness or inability to do these smoothly points to the cerebellum.
Got it. Now for the sensory system, this seems like it could take a while.
It can be detailed, but you have to be systematic. Key rules. Patient's eyes must be closed, and you need to test comparable areas on both sides of the body, hitting different dermatomes.
What are we testing first?
Start with the spinothalamic tract sensations. Light touch, using a cotton wisp. Pain, using something sharp like a broken cotton swab, alternating with the dull end to ensure they're not just feeling pressure. And sometimes temperature, using tuning forks, heated or cooled, though often deferred unless pain sense is abnormal.
And we already mentioned if light touch is impaired, especially distally.
You start thinking peripheral neuropathy. Diabetes, alcoholism are common causes.
Okay. After spinothalamic, we test the posterior columns.
Yes. Vibratory sensation is key. Use a low-pitched tuning fork, 128 hertz. Strike it, then place the bass firmly on a bony prominence. Start distally, like the tip of the big toe or the finger joints. Ask them if they feel the buzz and when it stops. Compare sides.
If they can't feel it distally, you move more proximally.
Exactly.
Oh.
Loss of vibration sense, especially starting distally, is a very sensitive indicator of posterior column disease or peripheral neuropathy. Then test position sense, proprioception. Hold their big toe or finger by the sides, move it slightly up or down, and ask them to tell you which way it moved, again with eyes closed.
So vibration and position sense, posterior columns.
Primarily, yes. Finally, we assess cortical sensory functions. These require the parietal lobe to interpret the basic sensory input.
Like identifying an object by touch.
Right, that's stereognosis. Put a familiar object like a key or a coin in their hand, eyes closed, and ask them to identify it. If they can feel it but can't tell you what it is, that's asteriognosis, suggesting a parietal lobe lesion.
What?
Graphesthesia. Draw a number or letter on their palm and ask them to identify it. Again, test parietal interpretation. And two-point discrimination. Use two sharp points, like an open paperclip, and touch their skin simultaneously. Find the minimum distance at which they can reliably tell if they're being touched by one point or two.
And this varies depending on the body part.
Hugely. On the fingertips, they should be able to discriminate points just 2 to 5 millimeters apart. On the back or forearm, it might be 40 millimeters or more. You're looking for significant differences side to side or values much larger than expected for that area, which again points to parietal lobe issues if basic touch is intact.
Okay, sensory system covered. Last big part of the objective exam, reflexes. Deep tendon reflexes, or DTRs.
Yes, testing the integrity of that reflex arc at specific spinal levels.
Mm-hmm.
Biceps C5, C6, triceps C7, C8, patellar L2, L4, Achilles, S1, S2 are the common ones. Need a reflex hammer, patient relaxed, strike the tendon briskly.
And the grading scale is vital here.
Absolutely critical for communication. It's a 0 to 4+ scale. 0 exhalation, absent no response. 1+ equals diminished or hypoactive. 2+ equals normal, average response. 3+ equals brisker than average, possibly hyperactive. 4+ equals very brisk, hyperactive, often associated with clonus.
So 2+ is the goal. What do the abnormal grades tell us?
This links back to our UM and LMN discussion. Hyperreflexia, 0 or 1+, generally points to an LMN lesion. The signal just isn't getting through the reflex arc properly at the spinal level, maybe due to nerve root compression or peripheral neuropathy.
And hyperreflexia.
Hyperreflexia, 3+ or 4+, strongly suggests an UMN lesion. The inhibitory signals coming down from the brain, via corticospinal tract mainly, are damaged, so the spinal reflex arc is unleashed and overreacts. Classic finding after a stroke or in conditions like MS affecting the spinal cord.
What's clonus again? You mentioned it with 4+3.
Clonus is seen with severe hyperreflexia. It's a series of rapid, rhythmic, involuntary muscle contractions. You usually test for it at the ankle.
Mm.
Quickly dorsiflex the patient's foot and hold it. If the foot then rhythmically beats back against your hand, that's clonus. Definitely an UMN sign.
Okay. And besides DTRs, there are pathological reflexes we look for?
Yes. The most important one in adults is the Babinski sign, testing the integrity of the corticospinal tract.
How do you do it?
Stroke the lateral aspect of the sole of the foot firmly with a semi-sharp object, from the heel up toward the little toe, then curving medially across the ball of the foot.
What's the normal response in an adult?
Normal is plantar flexion, the toes curl downward.
Or no response.
And abnormal, the positive Babinski. A positive Babinski response is dorsiflexion of the big toe. It goes up towards the head and often fanning out of the other toes. In an adult, this is always abnormal and indicates an UMN lesion affecting the corticospinal pathway. Note, Babinski is normal in infants up to about 1-2 years old. Okay, we've built the assessment framework. Now let's apply it to one of the most critical neurological emergencies, cerebrovascular accident, CVA, or stroke.
The brain attack, still a major cause of death and disability, right? Fifth leading cause of death in the U.S., the sources say.
That's right. And broadly, strokes fall into two main categories based on the cause.
Ischemic and hemorrhagic.
Exactly. Ischemic stroke is the most common type, maybe around 87% of them. This is where blood flow to the brain is blocked.
By a clot.
Usually, yes. Either a clot forms right there in a brain artery, thrombus, often due to atherosclerosis, or a clot travels from elsewhere, like the heart in atrial fibrillation, and lodges in a brain artery, embolus. Either way, brain tissue downstream doesn't get oxygen and starts to die. Infarction.
And the other type?
Hemorrhagic stroke. Less common, but often more deadly. This is where a blood vessel within the brain ruptures or leaks.
So bleeding into the brain tissue.
Right. This can happen if chronic high blood pressure weakens an artery wall, or if there's a congenital weakness like an aneurysm, a ballooning weak spot, or an arteriovenous malformation, AVM, a tangle of abnormal vessels. The bleeding itself damages brain cells, and the accumulating blood increases ICP, causing further damage.
What about TIAs, transient ischemic attacks? People call them mini strokes.
That term mini stroke is a bit misleading because TIAs are incredibly serious. The symptoms like sudden weakness, numbness, vision loss, speech trouble are the same as a stroke, but they resolve fully, usually within minutes to hours. Less than 24 hours by definition.
So no permanent damage.
Not necessarily permanent tissue death, but the critical point is that a TIA is a massive warning sign. It means there's an underlying problem causing temporary blockage, and the risk of having a full permanent stroke soon after is extremely high. A TIA needs urgent evaluation and treatment.
Good point. The sources also mentioned debunking some stroke myths. What are the key ones?
One big one is that strokes are inevitable or just bad luck. The fact is, experts estimate up to 80% of strokes are preventable through lifestyle changes and managing risk factors. That's huge.
Wow, 80%. What else?
The idea that stroke recovery only happens in the first few months. While the most rapid recovery often occurs early, improvement can continue for years thanks to brain plasticity and ongoing rehab. Also, stroke isn't rare, and it doesn't just happen to old people. It can affect younger adults and even children, though risks increase with age.
So prevention is key. Let's talk about those risk factors. Which ones can we actually do something about? The modifiable ones.
Top of the list, number one by far, is hypertension. High blood pressure, consistently over 1490. It damages arteries throughout the body, including the brain, making both ischemic and hemorrhagic strokes much more likely. Controlling blood pressure is probably the single most effective prevention strategy.
Okay, hypertension is number one. What else is big?
Diabetes mellitus damages blood vessels. Heart disease, especially atrial fibrillation, AFib, which can cause clots to form in the heart that travel to the brain. Smoking damages blood vessels, increases clotting. High cholesterol leads to atherosclerosis, plaque buildup, obesity, and a sedentary lifestyle, all major modifiable risks.
And there are risks we can't change, right? Unmodifiable.
Right. Age risk doubles each decade after 55. Gender, slightly higher risk in men at younger ages, but women catch up and have higher lifetime risk and mortality.
Yeah.
Race, ethnicity, African Americans, Hispanic Americans have significantly higher risk than white Americans, partly due to higher rates of hypertension and diabetes. And family history of stroke. Having these just means you need to be even more aggressive about controlling the factors you can change.
So what does that aggressive control look like? What's the core advice for client education on prevention?
It's comprehensive lifestyle management. Diet is huge. Emphasize fruits, vegetables, whole grains, lean protein like fish and poultry, low-fat dairy. Drastically cut back on saturated and trans fats, cholesterol, sodium, and added sugars. Avoid processed foods, fried foods.
And limit alcohol.
Definitely. Moderate consumption at most, if any. Exercise regularly. Aim for at least 30 minutes of moderate intensity activity most days of the week. Stop smoking. Absolutely essential. And then meticulously manage the medical conditions. Take blood pressure and diabetes medications as prescribed. Keep cholesterol in check. Manage AFib if present. It's a lifelong commitment.
Okay, prevention is ideal, but if a stroke happens, recognizing it fast is critical, right?
What?
You mentioned ACT FAST.
Yes. Everyone should know this acronym. It covers the most common signs. F is for face drooping. Ask the person to smile. Does one side of the face droop or look uneven? A is for arm weakness. Ask them to raise both arms. Does one arm drift downward or feel weak or numb? S is for speech difficulty. Ask them to repeat a simple sentence like, the sky is blue. Is their speech slurred? Are they unable to speak or hard to understand? Are they confused? And most importantly, T is for time to call 911. If you see any of these signs, even if they go away, call emergency services immediately. Don't wait.
Why is time so critical?
Because for ischemic strokes, there are treatments like clot-busting drugs, thrombolytics like TPA, or clot removal procedures that thrombectomy that can drastically reduce disability, but they have to be given within a very narrow time window, often just a few hours from when symptoms started. Time is brain. Every minute delay means more brain cells are potentially dying.
Are there other symptoms besides the fast ones to watch for?
Yes. Sudden confusion or trouble understanding speech, receptive aphasia. Sudden trouble seeing in one or both eyes could be blurred vision, double vision or complete loss of vision, sudden dizziness, trouble walking, loss of balance or coordination pointing towards cerebellum or brainstem, and a sudden severe headache with no known cause, often described as the worst headache of my life, which is a major red flag for a hemorrhagic stroke. Any of these warrant immediate medical attention. All right, let's delve into some of the more complex, often severe abnormal findings we might see, particularly in acute care or with significant neurological injury. Posturing is a big one in unconscious patients.
Right, these aren't voluntary movements. They're reflexive responses indicating severe brain damage.
Exactly. They reflect damage to specific motor pathways, resulting in characteristic involuntary body positions. There are two main types.
The first is decorticate posturing.
Yes. Decorticate, think towards the core. The arms are abducted, pulled into the body, and flexed, with wrists and fingers flexed on the chest. The legs are extended, internally rotated, and feet are plantar flexed.
And what does decorticate posturing typically indicate?
It suggests damage to structures above the midbrain, like the cerebral hemispheres, the internal capsule, or the thalamus. The pathways connecting the cortex to the brainstem are disrupted, but the brainstem itself might still be largely intact. It's serious, but generally considered slightly less ominous than the other type.
Which is decerebrate posturing.
Correct. Decerebrate, think away from the core, extension. Here, the arms are stiffly extended, adducted, and internally rotated, with wrists and fingers flexed. The legs are also stiffly extended with plantar flexion, often the back arches too.
And this suggests damage where?
Decerebrate posturing indicates damage at the level of the midbrain or upper pons within the brainstem itself. Because it involves damage to the brainstem, which controls vital functions, it's generally considered a more severe and prognostically worse sign than decorticate posturing. Sometimes patients can fluctuate between the two.
Very important distinction. We also see specific gait abnormalities with certain conditions.
Definitely. We mentioned the ataxic gait with cerebellar problems. Another classic is the Parkinsonian gait. Stooped posture, rigidity, shuffling small steps, festination, often difficulty starting or stopping, and reduced arm swing.
What about scissors gait?
You see that often with bilateral spastic paresis, like in cerebral palsy. The legs are stiff. Thighs tend to cross forward over each other with each step like scissors, often walking on tiptoes.
And after a stroke, you might say?
Spastic hemiparesis. The affected arm is often flexed and held close to the body, while the affected leg is extended and stiff. They often have to swing the leg outward in a semicircle to walk circumduction or drag the foot. Classic UMN pattern on one side.
We should also touch on tremors. You mentioned resting versus intention.
Right. Resting tremor, also called static tremor, is most prominent when the limb is at rest and supported. It often decreases or disappears with voluntary movement. The classic pill-rolling tremor of Parkinson's disease is the prime example.
And intention tremor.
This tremor is absent or minimal at rest, but gets worse as the person tries to perform a precise voluntary movement, like reaching for a target, finger-to-nose test. It often indicates cerebellar pathway disease. The closer they get to the target, the worse the tremor might become. Okay, now for some really specific, complex patterns. The spinal cord syndromes. These result from incomplete spinal cord injuries where only certain tracts are affected. Understanding these requires putting all the pathway anatomy together.
Let's start with Brown saccord syndrome. Sounds French.
It is, named after the neurologist who described it. This results from hemisection of the cord, meaning damage to only the right or left half, often from something like a stab wound or tumor on one side.
So what's the clinical picture? It must be strange if only half is damaged.
It's very distinct. Below the level of the lesion, the patient have loss of motor function, corticospinal tract, and loss of proprioception and vibration sense, posterior columns, on the same side, ipsilateral, as the injury.
Okay, motor and fine sensation lost on the same side.
But T, because the pain and temperature fibers, spinothalamic tract, cross over low down in the cord soon after entering, the patient loses pain and temperature sensation on the opposite side, contralateral, below the lesion.
Wow, so weakness and loss of position sense on one leg, loss of pain temp on the other leg. That's Brown saccor.
Exactly. Very specific pattern. Next is central cord syndrome.
What causes that, typically?
Often seen after a hyperextension injury to the neck, especially in older adults who already have some spinal stenosis narrowing. The damage is primarily to the central part of the cervical spinal cord.
And the pattern of deficits?
The hallmark is greater weakness in the upper extremities compared to the lower extremities. Sensory loss can be variable. Often, function in the legs and bowel bladder control, sacral segments, is preserved called sacral sparing.
So, arms weaker than legs, maybe some sensory loss below the injury, but Legs, relatively okay. That's central cord.
Typically, yes. Then there's anterior cord syndrome.
What's damaged here?
Usually caused by loss of blood supply from the anterior spinal artery.
Mm-hmm.
This knocks out the anterior two-thirds of the cord. So you lose function in the corticospinal tracts, motor, and the spinal tonic tracts, pain and temperature, below the lesion.
Meaning paralysis and loss of pain temp below the injury.
Correct. But because the posterior columns get their blood supply from elsewhere, proprioception, vibration, and fine touch are preserved, so they can feel vibration, know where their limbs are, but can't move them or feel pain temperature.
Okay. And the last one must be the opposite, posterior cord syndrome.
Exactly. This is much rarer. Damage is confined to the posterior columns, so the patient have profound loss of proprioception, vibration, and fine touch below the lesion.
But they can still move and feel pain.
Yes. Motor function, corticospinal pain, and pain temperature sensation, spinal thalamic, remain intact. So they might have significant difficulty walking due to lack of position sense, sensory taxia, but their muscle strength is normal.
Understanding those four really requires knowing where those tracts run in the cord.
Absolutely. It's pure applied anatomy.
Finally, just to round out abnormal signs, sometimes we need to check for meningeal irritation, right? If we suspect meningitis or subarachnoid hemorrhage.
Yes. Two classic signs. First is Brudzinski's sign.
How do you test that?
With the patient lying supine, you gently flex their neck forward, trying to touch their chin to their chest. A positive Brudzinski sign is when this neck flexion causes involuntary flexing of the patient's hips and knees. They automatically pull their legs up.
Why does that happen?
Because flexing the neck stretches the inflamed meninges and nerve roots, causing pain and reflex muscle spasm.
Okay. And the other sign, Koenig's sign.
Also done supine. You flex the patient's leg at both the hip and the knee to 90 degrees. Then you slowly try to straighten the knee, extending the lower leg. A positive Koenig sign is resistance to extension and significant pain in the hamstring area. Again, due to stretching inflamed nerve roots.
So Brudzinski's neck flex, leg flex, mm-hmm. and Koenig's leg extension causes pain resistance, both point towards meningeal inflammation.
Correct. They're helpful bedside indicators, though not perfectly sensitive or specific. Hashtag tag outro.
Wow. We have covered an incredible amount of ground today. From the basic wiring of the CNS and PNS, through every step of the detailed neurologic assessment, and deep into the clinical reasoning for stroke and those complex spinal cord syndromes.
It's a lot, but hopefully structuring it this way, anatomy, assessment, pathology, provides that clear map you need. This systematic approach is really the foundation for long-term understanding, not just cramming for one exam.
Absolutely. Connecting the dots between a specific sign like hyperreflexia and the underlying pathway, the UMN lesion, that's the goal.
It's about prediction. If you know the structure, you can predict the symptoms. If you know CN12, innervates the tongue muscles. Well, what happens if it's damaged? You predict tongue deviation. That's the clinical thinking we want you to develop.
It's true clinical reasoning.
Exactly. And to leave you with something to really think about, clamping back to that autonomic nervous system we discussed. Considering the ANS's vital role in maintaining homeostasis, heart rate, blood pressure, temperature, all that automatic stuff, how might a sudden catastrophic neurological event like a major stroke or high spinal cord injury completely derail the body's ability to self-regulate these vital functions in the immediate aftermath? And why is assessing and stabilizing these seemingly automatic functions often the very first priority in acute care, sometimes even before we get the full detailed neuro exam done?
That's a great question. Thinking about how fundamental that autonomic control is and what happens when the central command gets knocked offline, definitely something to mull over.
It links the basic physiology directly to critical care priorities.
Fantastic. Well, that brings us to the end of this deep dive. Thank you so much for guiding us through this.
My pleasure.
And thank you all for joining us. Hopefully, this detailed exploration serves as a valuable reference. We'll see you next time on the Deep Dive.